Hello, fellow travelers, and welcome to the Adventure of the Stars podcast. How are my loyal listeners? Thank you for your continued support. And as always, hit the subscribe button, everybody. We have an amazing show for you all, because boarding the mothership is Rob Wiley. You know him as the writer and director of River Road, now out on Apple Plus. Now come join me as we go traversing the stars.
Hello, Mr. Wiley. Thank you so much for coming to the Adventure of the Stars podcast.
Hey, Jeff. How's it going, man? Thanks for having me.
It's totally my pleasure, sir. I had a pleasure watching your movie. I thought it was absolutely fantastic.
Awesome. That's good to hear. Good to hear.
Oh, it's definitely my pleasure. So I always start off with a question of inspiration. So what inspired your love of film and who were your earliest influences?
Love of film? I mean, I guess it just comes from, yeah, my dad's side of the family is pretty film buffy, I'd say. So started early, I'd say, for really, you know, beyond just kid stuff, the first director I kind of connected with was like Oliver Stone. I saw the Doors movie pretty young. I was a big fan. And then I saw Platoon and kind of noticed, you know, this guy's an intense guy. I kind of like felt the vibe.
Mm.
And then from there, you know, by 12, 13, 14, it was Kubrick, Scorsese, you know, on the film buff path. So, you know, yeah, those are some major early influences, I'd say. Like, once you hit Kubrick, it kind of changes things, you know?
Right, right.
Like, oh, okay. You know, I think I saw Clockwork Orange, maybe a bit too young. By some extent. By 12, 13, I saw that. I was like, okay, this is crazy. This is next level stuff, you know?
Well, for me, my favorite Kubrick was The Shining. There's something about that movie that's just absolutely tremendous, and you want to live... Mm. I mean, I guess you don't want to live in that world a little while, but you want to see that world a little bit longer, go a little bit deeper into it.
you want to live in the Shining world? Yeah, I'll admit it straight up. I think around the same age, you know, like 12, 13, I think we were at my friend's place and having like a movie night, and those twins popped up and I was out, man. That was too scary for me. I was like, I am out of here. But then a couple years later, watched it and like, I love it now for sure. Yeah.
There's something about creepy kids that just stare at you. You're like, go away. Why are you so freaky?
Yeah, the first time he goes around the corner and they're there and they're like playing with his Danny. And you're like, I'm out, dude. Like, it scared the bejesus out of me.
Yeah, I don't think there's the one where the guy's dressed up as a dog. And I think when I first saw that, I was really young. I didn't understand what the hell was happening there. I was like, what is that? As a dog, I was like, oh.
he goes into the one room. That's hilarious. Yeah, that's kind of funny now, actually, seeing that.
Yeah, as a kid, like I said, I don't think I understood. I just thought it was like, wow, that's an unusual scene. Now as a dog, I'm like, oh.
Yeah. Did you like Ready Player One when they went into the Shining world? Did you see that?
I enjoyed Ready Player One. I thought they did a good job. I thought the book did it better, but I thought the movie was fantastic.
Yeah, yeah, it was just kind of cool. See, like then when they went into the Shining, that's kind of a cool idea.
Yeah, I really like the way they were able to weave in all the references and really make it work and make it interesting. And you never can go wrong with Kubrick. I did enjoy the sequel as well. I think it was called Dr. Sleep. I thought it was well done.
Yeah, I really liked it. I thought that was cool. Yeah, it was a good sequel.
Yeah, well, you can't go wrong with Ewan McGregor.
Yeah, yeah. No, telling me, man, I'm all about Trainspotting, you know. No, yeah.
Right, absolutely. Right. Oh, that's a great movie too. So you are, before you were a director, you're also a guitarist for a rock band. So love of music first or love of film first?
I think music first is my mom's a piano teacher. So it's kind of like, you know, we were playing instruments pretty early on, definitely. So music first, I'd say. And then even around, you know, like 14, 15, you know, was playing in bands and was film buff. But again, there was more mystery around film as far as, you know, what, you know, how to actually make a film. I had in my mind I wanted to. So it was kind of more, I started doing music videos for my bands in my 20s. Maybe I was like 23 when I made the first one. And so I was kind of doing it simultaneously, but definitely I was focusing on music first and then, you know, did the band thing, the touring thing. And then, you know, when that kind of ended and then started getting into film and, here we are, the second movie, and, you know, here we are.
Well, I think the cool thing is, I think every teenager thinks to themselves, I want to be a rock star, or I want to be, like, a TV movie star director.
There you
Most of
go.
us,
That's
yeah,
me.
right. And most of us give up at like 18. We're like, eh, that's not gonna happen. That's impossible. You said apparently, no, nah, that's me, and it you did it. So
Well,
how the
I mean, I did it. Well, I
hell
mean,
did
I did it. I mean, it's not, but there, it's not that, it's not, it sounds, when you put it that way, it sounds really cool. And I'm like, yeah, that is cool. But again, you know, there's a lot of, it wasn't, you know, you're trying to get a record deal that didn't happen, you know, so there's a lot of pain involved as well as a lot of great things when it came to the music side of things, you know, it was frustration. Same thing with movies too. It's a tough, they're both tough games, and to ignore the reality of how savage just trying to make a full-length feature film on a low budget is, and just completing it and trying to get it out there. You know, they're both, it's very difficult to do both, actually, it turns out. So, you know, I'm just here
So,
trying to get better.
both of those things are highly creative endeavors, making music and making film. Was it the creativity that drew you to it, or was it the challenge of this is things that most people don't think they can do, and I bet I can. So which one was the bigger motivator?
No, it's definitely the creative first. Absolutely. I think, yeah, because you don't know how hard it is. Like, you're so ignorant and young and naive. You don't know. Like, you're like, okay, of course, we're gonna start playing shows. We're gonna get a record deal, you know, within a year or two, then we're gonna be touring. But it doesn't work like that. The same thing with movies, you know, like when we made our first movie almost 10 years ago, you know, it's the same thing. Oh, it's gonna blow up at festivals, it's gonna do this, it's gonna do that. And it doesn't work out that way, but you do get better and you do learn. You know, as you get a little older, you kind of realize, okay, you know what? Getting better, and you know, improving. And what else can you really do? Because there's only so many things you control, but you try to improve at every stage of the game, you know, from the writing all the way through to finishing the film. Just try to get better. And maybe, as you're saying, maybe on this film, I kind of, after making my first movie and completing it, maybe what you're saying is a little bit more appropriate, because I was like, oh, I actually can do this. A lot of people, it is difficult. A lot of people can't do it. So that was, you know, it's like I can make this happen.
So how does music and film activate different creative muscles in you?
Ooh. Yeah, it's definitely different. To be honest, there's a lot of separation there. It's a lot different, you know, trying to, like, I'm a songwriter, you know, for rock, essentially rock pop, guitar rock pop, you know. That's definitely a different, you know, than writing a full-length feature movie, because it is, even it, like, I'm not really gonna do a concept album, you know, it's not really my thing. So you are focused literally on 3, 4 minute, 5 minute songs, and the puzzle and the craft of that is very different. But there are, the most similar process, I would say, in both, and what I did learn by being in the studio, in the recording studio, is there's time pressure. You know, you're paying an engineer, you're paying a producer, you got to get these drums done tonight. So the clock is ticking. And then essentially, what is very similar is you're capturing a performance and then you're editing it. So if your time pressure's on, same thing with filming, like the sun is going down, like you got this location, boom. So you have to be very, I think I was developing the muscle, which is, you know, same thing, like our drummer's playing a song. It's like, okay, so he does two takes of the full song, and then we don't have time to keep doing it. We just got to punch in. We got to punch in. Okay, you know what? We know we got the first verse. I know I got the last chorus. Let's punch in on the pre-chorus. Let's just focus on that. Same thing with when you're working with actors, it's like they kind of run it like it's a play, you know, they run the scene, and then time is ticking. It's like, you know what? You just kind of have to know, okay, I got the master shot of that performance. Let's just punch in, just do that one line. Let's just focus on that. Do that 5 times. Okay, good. And again, it's just, so that I'd say is the most similar. And also try, and dramatizing is also a thing too, because in a song you want it to be entertaining. It can't be boring. So you are looking to make things dangerous, and dramatizing it, it's more poetic. It's a different medium. But same thing with film, you're looking for conflict, you're looking to entertain. So those are, yeah. Anyways, yeah.
So when you're writing a song, similar to screenplay writing, are you first developing a short story for the song, or are you developing first a feeling for the song and a story builds around it?
Yeah, it's the feeling. Oh, so There's a difference between most of the songwriting I do is accidental. So I'm fiddling around on a guitar or a vocal line will hit you. And then you kind of have, especially when you're playing guitar, you come up with some notes and you come up with a riff, you come up with chord changes, and that has a certain atmosphere and vibe to it, minor key, major key, all different modes. Is it kind of a little Latin feel? Is it like this? And that kind of dictates where you go with the lyrics. Maybe it's a bit opposite with film, which is you kind of have a broad idea first of what the tone of the film is going to be, what the atmosphere, like this movie, the first ideas was like, okay, a couple for River Road, a couple fall in love, get into heroin, get you I kind of knew that was the overall picture and then went into it.
So when you start the screenplay, then you're doing story first, then feeling, or feeling still first, and then a story to kind of build upon it.
Well, I guess the feeling is the overall, the feeling I would apply to just the overall kind of like literally you just like the tagline almost is the first thing you kind of think of, which is like, musician falls in love with a free-spirited woman and they go into heroin and crime. So that's kind of a feeling and a vibe, but there is a sense of, but it develops as it goes along, especially like before then, but you mentioned the music that developed. I was like, okay, I think I want to do some 80s synth kind of score to this, and then that develops as I was working with the co-composer, and then so it's very generalized at first, and then it gets squeezes, and then once you finish the script, and then once you shoot it, then you edit it, and then it gets very focused. Whereas now you see River Road, it's very focused. The music is this kind of thing, it's this kind of vibe. Again, when you start, it's a lot broader, but for the most part, you kind of know the direction you're going
So in River
in.
Road, the protagonist is Travis, a guitarist. You are also a guitarist. Should we look at all as this as a somewhat autobiographical
Well,
view?
it's actually less than you'd think, because the first actor that I kind of developed the movie for was also a guitar player, also in bands. And so it's less autobiographical than you'd think. I mean, I know the world. I know the world of addiction and guitar players and bands, but it's not a true story of there are definitely little nuggets of true things that actually happened along the way for sure, but I wouldn't call it autobiographical.
Well, like I said, I thought River Road was a fantastic movie. And well, the question I had is, okay, so the protagonist is Travis in my view. Now, for every protagonist, there's an antagonist. Now, for me, I'm thinking to myself, is it Zoe? Is it Travis? Is it the heroine? Which one is the antagonist in your mind?
Ooh. I would say the antagonist, I would say is the addiction, is the heroin. Because that's the thing with Fresno. I mean, Fresno's just there having a good the drug dealer. He's just there having a good time. And in a way, Travis is the antagonist. But it's about the two people that, engage in a compulsive behavior that's very damaging to them. And in this case, it's heroin, because we did want to take it to an extreme. But there's a lot of people, you could do it with all sorts of things. You could do it with overeating. You could do it with overdrinking. You could do it with all sorts of compulsive, kind of damaging behavior where you and another person, if they're on their own, would they really get into that amount of naughtiness? Maybe, maybe not.
See, when I was watching it, I was thinking to myself, Travis seemed like he was going to be fine if it wasn't for her. She seemed to be looking for trouble because without giving away the ending of a reveal later on, because I don't want to spoil anything. It seemed like she had a direction in mind that she was headed down, and that avalanche was coming.
I think you're right. Yeah, no, absolutely. Yeah, in a way, yeah, so you're right. In a way, she could be viewed as an antagonist, but her intention, as it does show, I don't, again, don't want to give it away, but it does kind of show from her perspective, her intention. And again, it might not be, I'd say, it doesn't look great what she ended up doing, but in her mind, she's just trying to fall in love,
Was it a difficult balance writing her? Because we'll see, without giving anything away, there's a very fine line between her intention and the outcome, and where how much of it was intentional, how much was manipulation, how much was what. Was it a fine line to determine what if you're vilifying her, or is she kind of her own tragic figure by the desire that she wants?
Well, that's a good question. That was well put. And I like the way you said that, an own tragic figure. I think that's more the case. Yeah. You know,
So,
her intention is not really to manipulate, it's not to be, to really ruin anyone's life or anything. I think she's it has her own issues.
that part is true.
It tries to explain again. I don't want to give away because there's a big twist and there's a lot of, she tries to explain it. I think we did a good job of showing her perspective and, why she made the choices she did. Hopefully, it did a good job at that. And then
Well,
it's kind of more open-ended, and you could kind of decide there's not really any bad person. It's just kind of, hopefully, it's somewhat realistic.
So, I mean, the interesting thing I think is that there's definitely the Sid and Nancy, like volatile. You put these two chemicals together, things explode. And I think that's a very interesting, where, I mean, is that something to be said about relationships on the whole, that certain mixtures don't belong, or maybe the same thing that creates that volatile passion is the same thing that also causes the explosion after?
Oh, totally. I mean, oh, all the time. I mean, especially when it comes to, when actors date or creative people date, there's a little, they're very passionate and the highs are very high, the lows are very low. And, it's the two energies combusting. But yeah, it is kind of, there's something about the rock and roll, that Sid and Nancy thing that's, again, it's entertaining because they're kind of crazy people or like that. Kurt and Courtney vibe, and the Bonnie and Clyde kind of thing too is what we're trying to do as well, and it's entertaining, and it is what we're kind of going for.
You know, that's cool that you said Bonnie and Clyde. In my head, I was thinking to myself, the gangster couple. So I was like, I was going to use them as a reference, but I couldn't quite come up with the names quite right. I kept saying Butch Cassidy. I was like, it's not Butch Cassidy. It's not what it was for. But I'm glad that you said it for me because it would have aggravated me all day long.
Yeah, that would be the woke 2022, Butch Cassidy and
Yeah.
the
Like I honestly got, I would have, I literally would have been spending the entire day just kicking myself trying to figure out the name. I've been on, I sort of this
Sundance
interview over, first thing Google and trying to figure
Yeah.
it
Well, yeah,
out.
no, for sure. Yeah, that's kind of the vibe, and again, it's not, we're trying to tell it, in a use Vancouver as a backdrop, which never is used as itself. They film a lot of movies in Vancouver, and it's always pretending to be somewhere else. I don't know if you know too much about that on the East Coast, but
Supernatural TV show. I love Supernatural, the TV show, always shot in Vancouver, based on a road trip in the United States, never filmed in
yeah, no,
the United
it's all the time, and that's part of the thing. So we're trying to, and everyone in the film essentially it's a regional film, in a way, because everyone's from BC. Yeah, I think cast and crew are pretty much all from BC. So yeah. We're trying to represent a little bit, show a
States.
little bit. It's not that different from the States, of course, but there's the little things that hopefully it's got its own flavor,
So how much is the location a character in the movie then?
I tried to make it a pretty big character, especially with the, yeah, you could tell the same story somewhere else, and that's cool, but it would be a different film. What I liked about Delta, the kind of the on the outskirts of Vancouver, it's part of Greater Vancouver, but it's its own city, which is all, it's farmland. And then literally on, it's actually is River Road. On one side of the street, you'll see in the movie I'm filming, like the scene of Zoe at the bus stop. That's all farmland in the background. I turn the camera, 180 degrees on the other side of the road, and it's literally the river. There's boats. It's a marine environment. It's all right there. Boom, boom. So, like that dock scene in the film is literally across the street from farmland. So it's all kind of right there. And then we also incorporate, a little bit of Vancouver as a city as well. So, and then there's a lot of visual elements to that. So hopefully, it has its own character,
Well, what I think I liked about the way it was filmed is that it seemed to reflect very well the mindset of Travis at any given moment. It alternates between this kind of dreamlike feeling to it, and also then it kind of goes into this frenetic style. The more Travis delves into the heroine, the filming seems to alter a bit as well to this kind of frenetic style. I really liked how it mirrors Travis, and how intentional was that mirroring?
Yeah, it's pretty intentional. Again, we're working on a low budget here, and with the camera work, I like handheld camera, but yeah, I mean, I definitely tried to in the later in the later scenes when things are getting bad. Definitely more gritty with the handheld, a lot of movement, just kind of following the actors. And at the beginning, it's definitely more level. And you just, again, it's not something that I've really thought about too much. It's just kind of naturally the rhythm of the scenes. And so just try to, yeah, I'm glad you picked up on that. That's cool though.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah.
So as a director, when you're working with these actors, some of them newer actors, what do you think was the best method to kind of draw out their best performance? Are you a hands-on director? Are you kind of like an backed up, and you let the actors do what they want to do? What's your style like?
I definitely go hands-on style, because I was an actor for, in high school, I was acting before directing, just theater stuff, nothing crazy, but I understand, and I'm a performer on stage, so I understand the actor's mindset, so I'm pretty hands-on. But that being said, you have to know when to back off too. For the most part, I wouldn't say there's a specific method. You're just trying to set up an atmosphere, an environment to get so that they can perform comfortably their best. And you never really know what's going to work as far as, I don't really have a method. It's just kind of you show up. Usually they have their script, they do a couple takes, and then boom, I just kind of instinctively, okay, now let's try this a bit faster. Let's do this here. Sometimes they're totally in sync and on point, and you just let them do their thing. It totally depends, literally depends on the scene. It depends on the line. Sometimes you got to follow the script exactly. That word's got to be this word, or else it means something else. And sometimes on another line, you're just like, hey, you know what? That line doesn't work. Do you want to just make something up? They make something up. So there's really, I like to keep it pretty, keep the flow of it. So I'm not very rigid, if that makes sense. I'm not rigid in one method, one style. I keep it flow. We can improv here. We stick exactly to the script here, and every variation in between, we'll alter one word there. We'll do this. We'll go faster. We'll go slower. Try whatever you want. So that, and I like to do a lot of takes and a lot of variations so that when you get to the editing room, you could really craft it in the editing room. You really know what's going to work then.
So are you are you virtually self-taught for directing, or did you go to a school to learn what you know already, or is it just you just read a shit ton and you just knew what you were doing?
Well, no, it's self-taught. So I started music videos. And then, in a weird way, I mean, no one talks about this too much, but at the exact time in the mid 2000s, it was the DVD boom. No one talks about it. I never heard anyone talk about it. It was the DVD boom, which was crazy because all of a sudden I got a making of documentary on every single movie that I've ever liked that is classic. I mean, it was like nonstop. It was like, boom, here's this one on One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest with all your favorite movies, like the 3-hour making of Blade Runner. I'm like, fantastic. Let's do this. The alien making of on all three. It's just like I was just literally in hog heaven. I couldn't even believe it existed. Because in the growing up in the 90s and stuff, you just had VHS tapes. There was no making of. Maybe there's a couple, like Lawrence of Arabia, some ghetto ass like 70s like thing about that, but no. And it was all of a sudden commentaries, and then books, and it was like nonstop out of nowhere. All of a sudden, literally, I'm talking, within 2 years, it was VHS, or even in like 2003 to 2004, all of a sudden every VHS was gone from the rental stores, all DVDs. Here's a making of documentary non-stop coming out. So I was just loving it, man, and just absorb just learning that way, as well as just doing it myself. Music video.
For me, I think the best one I ever saw was the one on Jaws. There's one on Jaws called the Shark Works, I think it's called. The Shark Does Work. I think that's what something along the line. It's not on every DVD, but it's on a couple of them. And it's showing on like I think it was on like History Channel or Discovery, one of those two. And I've watched that so many times. I think I've watched that more than the actual movie because it's so freaking smart.
No, that's the thing. No, I think I know what you're talking about, because there's a couple different Jaws makings. I think I've seen the one that you're talking about. And it's crazy because it's like 2.5 hours. And as you said, sometimes I've watched The Making of Alien, I think more than an Alien more than I've watched the movies. I love, and yeah, the Jaws one's crazy because you look at it and you don't understand the pain he went through. I mean, he thought he was going to get fired the whole time. He
Yeah.
didn't want to do it at first. The shark wasn't working. It was crazy. Richard Dreyfuss is like, this is going to be the worst movie ever.
Right.
Like,
Right.
and then it talks about the. You know that first screening where the executives and it just went mental, and they're like, "We're gonna get this in every single movie
Yeah.
theater on the." You know, I love that documentary. That's what I'm talking about, man. It's great, and all of a sudden, all that stuff was available out of nowhere, and
It's amazing the it kind of it's so motivating because you're watching because like now we know Spielberg becomes, you know, the Spielberg, you know, he's like the god of directing. But to watch that first that documentary, you see just how much failure was involved and just how bad it, I mean, the experience was awful. I mean, when you talked about I walked away from the last shot because I thought they were gonna dump me in the water. I was like, shit, that's Spielberg.
I know, and that's the thing. What he was like, literally, in his like 26, 27, 28. And then I watched his movie before, Duel, his first movie is kind of cool. But then the one before that, it's like, I don't know. I'm not hating on it, but it's not that good. Like, I forget what it's called. But you know what I mean? He was just this guy. And all of a sudden, but then he talks about it. He was traumatized. He'd come back to the studio, I guess, after they shot. He was so traumatized. They brought the boat back, from Jaws, the boat, and they put it on the Universal lot, and he would go by himself and just sit in there and just like process the trauma. And
Wow.
you realize what they had to go through. And also Coppola with Apocalypse Now, it's crazy. And you think that, I think sometimes the public thinks that these people are just these blessed artists and they're
Yeah.
genius and they're just so successful that they don't understand. And from these documentaries and books, you understand what they went through and the pain and
Yeah, I
how to
agree. I mean, it tells you a lot about the idea of, you know, genius in the moment apparently isn't very obvious. When Spielberg talks about like when John Williams showed him the Jaws score for the first time, and he's like, "Show me the score for the shark." And he goes, and he does that, you know, that little thing. And I think that Spielberg saying, "I thought to myself, what the hell is this crap? That's all. That's the whole thing." And then he started kept thinking about it more and more. And he's like, "Oh, now this makes sense to me." But yeah, but I thought it was amazing that his first thought of hearing John Williams' score was the classic score is, "Are you making fun of me? What is this?" You know.
And then, as you say, I mean, that's the thing. And also, if you watch the making of documentary, like you just described, there's that one moment. Well, what if Spielberg was just like, nah, I don't want that
Right.
score? It's the most famous score of all time, if at least in the top three or four of all time, 100%. Yeah, he was able to trust John Williams on that, and just it could have gone the other way if he had a different personality. He'd be like, nah. And then
Right.
there's Kubrick, who had the score for 2001. I mean, he had that composer do an entire score, paid him tons of money, this Oscar-winning composer. And then Kubrick's like, nah, I like the music I came up with, the Strauss Waltz
Right.
and stuff. He's like, I'm just gonna use that. And then it was, but what if Kubrick had been a little bit more of a wussy and being like, I don't want to let this composer down. And you could hear that score probably on YouTube. And it's like, eh. But then his use of the Strauss waltz and the beginning, the Thus Spake Zarathustra, this famous intro to 2001 is one of the most famous uses of music in the history of film. But it just goes down to those one little
Right.
moments. What if they had decided something else?
So, what did you like? Because I'm sure, as someone who's when you've done your film and your music videos, there are times when things haven't gone your way, or someone's like, nah, how much, like, where did you find your conviction from? Is it from watching these documentaries and seeing how these geniuses are often sometimes said, like, nah? Is that where your conviction comes from and goes, no, I'm right. I know I'm right. I'm plugging, you know, I'm pushing forward on this.
Conviction, that's interesting you brought that up, because yeah, I mean, conviction does have a lot to do with it. Yeah, I mean, it's tough because it's a tough line that you have to balance, because sometimes I make wrong decisions all the time, and you have to know when to listen to people, and then you do have to know when to put your foot down and say, no, I'm right. And you're right, I think it all adds up. All the research, at the end of the day, I've done my research. I've read all these books, all these directors. So I've done my research. I've also, besides the music, even before that, my first thing was drawing. So I was an artist since I was, 7 or 8. And I think I didn't know it at the time. I think I was lucky. A lot of people, I was getting a lot of praise, I guess, for being good for my age. And then I guess perhaps I have some sort of confidence or conviction from that just ingrained in me. Sorry, I don't know if you hear it. There's a motorcycle in the background, but my roommate. Yeah, so I don't know. Yeah, I mean, you just have to trust your gut a lot of the time when it comes to that thing.
So what, another interesting thing about when the decisions you made in this to make this movie is how you narrated the film. So a lot of the movie is basically Travis sort of narrating it to his sponsor, who, if I remember correctly, the sponsor, he's in Supernatural, isn't it? If I remember correctly, is a
I think every Vancouver actor is in Supernatural.
I keep thinking that
Oh
he's like the evil, the demon Bobby in one of the episodes, season
yeah.
six, isn't
Aaron's
it?
in a lot of he's a vet. He's a hardcore Vancouver vet. He's in every Vancouver show he has makes an appearance in, yeah. So what was the question?
So, what led to the choice to basically have it narrated through Travis talking to his sponsor?
Oh, okay. I think that just came from an artistic decision. I think my last film, Dark Cove, was I wrote it linear, fairly linear. And then I kind of realized later after it was done, and I kind of realized that I just think it would have been stronger doing it with flashbacks and having, and actually we did reshoot some stuff, and I am going to re-edit the movie. I just thought it was a better device for this kind of movie because you could kind of like tease things. So he says, let me, at the very beginning of the movie, he's like, let me tell you about the first time I ever committed armed robbery. And then it's like, boom, and you tease it. So the audience is kind of like, oh, shit's going to go down in this movie. And you could tease things. And like, even, before a scene that you could kind of, it's a lot about, of it is about just kind of like setting the audience up and teasing things more. It's just a narrative device that I wanted to explore.
So another interesting moment in the movie is Travis is talking to Zoe. This is kind of like one of their bonding moments where he shares a story about his father, which I don't think gives away any spoilers right now to discuss it. And is the story, how is the story being used to kind of explain where we are with Travis at this point? And is the story also meant to develop empathy for Travis, given what we know of what he will be doing at some point later in the story?
I mean, I think it's, yeah, I think you said it correctly. I think it's both those things, he's telling a bit of his background because at the end of the day, most people who kind of indulge in, I know a lot of my friends are addicts and stuff. There's usually some sort of childhood trauma. And again, his case isn't necessarily that extreme, but it's there. And to him, it's a big deal what he talks about. And I like having some character development. I like knowing some backstory about characters. And I think I like hearing about, maybe it's just my taste. I like hearing about characters' childhoods. I like that kind of depth. Some people don't like that kind of depth. I do. Not all the time. Depends how it's handled. Hopefully it's handled correctly.
So, how early in the conception of Travis was that story developed?
Ooh, interesting. Interesting case. I think also it has to do with the ebb and flow of the film, which was at that point in time, I thought there would be a nice time before things get really wild and crazy. It'd be a nice, there is kind of like that, whatever it is, 10 minutes where it could kind of slow the film down and you kind of get this scene. So I think it has to do with not only the flow of the movie. I don't think I'd map that scene out in the outline. I think it just kind of got to that point. It just kind of felt like, okay, we could slow things down here. We could have this kind of intimate scene and reveal some things. I think it just kind of happened naturally and was both. It was, learning a bit more about Travis before things get crazy, and calming the film down a bit before things get crazy.
Because you also had that background a little bit on Zoe as well at that moment. And like I said, I thought it was a very interesting, and I think it was interesting talking about ebbs and flows of the movie. It felt seamless, and it did give you a sense of who he was. And I thought that was very clever.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, and I'll be honest, there was more. There was Zoe did have another story there, like a monologue there as well. It's something that I overwrite monologues a little bit, but it's just in the editing, I had to just cut it back and focus more on Travis, or else it was just a little crossing the line a little bit too much. So unfortunately, you learn a little bit less about Zoe, but I just couldn't t take that much time on that scene. So I
So
thought, yeah.
what do you think is would have been the impact of knowing Zoe better? Given that of her character and kind of the catalyst that she is, would that have been, if you had to do, let's say the option was given to a director's cut of a film of River Road, would that you think of giving having that information help you understand her, or would that have taken away from kind of a this mysterious girl who, from the outsider who shows up?
Yeah, I think it also has to do with like even just what we shot. I think it just happened to do with my writing. I just wasn't really happy with the way it turned out. So I wouldn't put that in the director's cut. I don't think so. It's been a while since I looked at it. And I think, and again, as you say, I think I was thinking like, oh, would this really help? I don't think it really revealed it enough that it made a difference. And as you say, sometimes having a little mystery is not a bad thing. And that's the tough thing about deciding whether to get into that character backstory with Travis, because that's what I thought. I was like, you know what? It works for Travis. It doesn't work for Zoe. Maybe having both too much is too much, because sometimes having mystery is good. And that's the line you got to cross, right?
Well, was there ever a concern of losing the audience sympathy for Travis, given that eventually he goes down that road, eventually he does what he does? Was there ever concern of the audience being like, ah, he's kind of a dick now? Or was there, or did you develop, or how did, what decisions did you make to make sure the audience is stuck with Travis throughout?
I think, yeah, no, I wasn't concerned, because I think that audiences actually, I think sometimes people, when it comes to like, big, TV shows on a major network, they're just kind of pussies about, the sympathy of the characters. But at the end of the day, it's like, I think Tony Soprano is one of the best characters of all time. It's like he's killing people all the time. It's like, people actually, at the end of the day, in a certain context, people want the lead character to do some crazy shit. Or like to be a little dangerous, you know what I mean? Depending on the story. I think people like seeing him go to that side because I think people have it in themselves. They can cross over and do behavior like that. They might not know it, but it doesn't take much. You know what I mean? So I wasn't concerned. And
So
also Cody as an actor, he's just kind of a nice, likable guy anyway. So once we cast him, I was like, okay, this isn't going to be a problem. In fact, honestly, let's make him more badass and crazy,
Well, like I said, you did give it the audience a chance to live vicariously through this guy, and watch as you watch him spiral. So I thought that was very, it was very interesting. The other thing, I mean, you obviously what you did with your script must have, you did a great job. For no other reason, you were nominated for a Lear Award for best screenwriting and best lead performance. Well, Travis, the guy who played Travis, a lead performance. So how much confidence does that give in yourself and in the movie, that nomination?
Well, yeah, I mean, the thing about, awards are always weird, for art. But that being said, this is the Vancouver film industry, and we're very much, let's just say, we're very much rebels on the outside going into this, with our funding. We had no grant money, no government grant money, no, it's low budget, just on, by the seat of our pants production. And in that regard, it was really cool to get all these nominations. And we won a couple Leos, Fresno won for Best Supporting Actor, we won for Best Music. And again, just getting the nomination for Best Picture, Best Director, and all those nominations, I was surprised. And I was like, you know what? It felt good. I'm not gonna lie. I'm not gonna lie to you. Because it was a sense of validation, being like, we're the bad boys, we're coming in, just, no permits, just scrounging, And I think hopefully it doesn't. I don't think it really comes across how low budget it was and how guerrilla it was and how and what we went through to make the movie. So it does feel good to get, you know, from Vancouver film industry to be like, you know what, good job, guys. And I'm like, cool, thanks.
Do you introduce yourself now as Leo nominated director and
I'm
screenwriter?
a Leo winning. I won for best music.
Okay.
So, but I'm not shockingly, I'm not a douchebag.
No,
So I don't do that.
like,
Actually, I'm a little bit, no, just kidding.
what kind of opportunities did this now open doors for you now that you've done River Road? You've made a successful movie. You've been now a winner and nominated. So what doors are now open for you and what's next?
Yeah, so we've been. What's next? We might actually be doing a Fresno spinoff. I'm serious. I'm not
Oh,
joking.
very cool.
In a different style, very different style of film, but kind of more a crime thriller. So it'd be more like The Departed and Heat meets Stand By Me. We're exploring that. And that would be, you know, again, we're just trying to step up our game, get better, step up the level of production. Our first movie, Dark Cove, was here on Vancouver Island, which is where I live. Local amateur actors, blah, blah, blah. The next, you know, River Road is professional Vancouver actors, still a scrappy production. And the goal is the next one to be bigger, more professional, more resources, hopefully be better at what I do and just keep getting better and growing. So that's the game plan. So I think it has opened up doors. Absolutely.
So where can our listeners find River Road?
River Road is available. Yeah. Apple TV, pretty much anywhere. In the States and the UK, it's on Amazon Prime to rent. And it is on Google Play everywhere as well and YouTube movies. Yeah.
Well,
To rent. Yeah.
Mr. Wyatt, while it was a pleasure talking with you, sir, you're fantastic, and I really enjoyed River Road.
Yeah. Oh, cheers, Jeff. I'm glad you liked the movie, man. Thanks for having me. That was an awesome conversation, man. You too. See you later.